Kohen's Kedusha. You see that over here, he has to be in a completely different framework. He has to be in a totally different framework. And to the extent that he's a human being and he has emotions, they will be affected by his dress. But the Bedouin over here cannot, are totally different. They're based upon objective criteria, and it's a complete removal from his normal human personality. And that I think is a very vital thing, because Jade mentioned that, specifically by Kavanah, by the Mishkan and so forth, it always mentions that Moshe and Aaron, it always mentions that they did exactly as God had told them to do. And Rashi always says, Malam Shoshina, they didn't need to make any changes. You know, so the question is, why was Moshe and of all people, why was he making any changes? And he pointed out that in this area, in the area of Avoda, when it comes to the Migdash, there's any deviation, any projection of a person's own emotions that constitutes the best way of Avoda Zara. We can't create our own system of worship. Now, I would say, along these lines, because of the Rambam and the Mora, that, you know, because the Rambam's idea basically is that the whole system of Kabbalah is basically a concession. It's basically, that's the Rambam Shita, that the reason why God gave us Kabbalah is the danger of Kabbalah. Because Kabbalah can cater, if it's not done properly, it can cater to the primitive instinctual part of man, and can lead a person to idolatry. But nevertheless, he said that that it would have been impossible to have a Torah system without Kabbalah. Is that the idea of carbon was very deeply ingrained. Because just like in our time, a person would start a religion and it would be purely based upon abstract ideas without the things like tzvila, without davening. So people couldn't relate to that kind of thing. But they need certain activities which appeal to their emotional needs as well. So the Torah takes it, and it enables them to have that, but through the medium of a system which is based on true ideas. So the system of Karbanos is crucial. And along these lines, if you go through Moshe, if you go through the Rambam and the Mora, you'll see that it only makes sense. You see that there are tremendous limitations on Karbanos, because not everybody can, you can't just bring a Karban. You have to, first of all, the Beit HaMikdash was built, so it was Nasar, all the Bamos. So you can only go, the primary protection is the fact that there's a Beit HaMikdash, and then it's given over to the Kahuna. It's given over to the Kahuna. Why? Because you can't just have anybody, you cannot have anybody being involved in the Avodah. There has to be a special class of people that are trained, that are experts, and so on and so forth. So, therefore, I would say that the idea of Mechaper, is understood in a different way. That it's part of, it's in the framework of the system. The Mechaper is built into the way the system was designed in such a way to make the Kohanim aware of certain emotions that the people have, and therefore to perfect themselves. In other words, the perfection of the people over here to a large extent will be dependent upon the perfection of the Kohanim. Because once the responsibility is transferred to the Kohanim, so then, you know, everything depends upon them. If they're corrupt in certain areas, then this will come through. And therefore, that would explain all the severe requirements upon the Kohanim themselves. You know, that they can't be the Tana and the Bedudim and so on and so forth. Because the entire institution of Karban is dependent upon them. It's not like other areas where everybody, Torah, you have the Bali and Asar, but anybody in Kwal Yisrael. All people in Kwal Yisrael are obligated to study Torah. And there's no one particular class that's been entrusted with that mission. But here, it was the intention to remove this, to remove Karban from being accessible to each and every person, and to transfer it to a particular class, and therefore they have to be perfected in the area, and insofar as the begotten takes them out of a certain framework, a certain type of a self image that they may have, and puts them in a different framework, then that's a significant vehicle. That's extremely important. Every element of the avoda is important. And therefore, there will be elements in the begotten that will relate to certain emotions that the people have. And if you understand those emotions, so then that will be a protection against the particular sin that they are associated with. And that's the mechapa. See, so it's using the term in a completely different way. It's not like they committed a sin, and now, because that doesn't make any sense. Because if you're talking about a particular sin that was committed at a certain time and place, so then why should that result in a whole new institution of very many living? It's going to be mechaper for what? For a sin that was committed in the past? So we're using it in a different sense. It's a mechaper in the sense that we're taking every measure to prevent this type of a sin from ever coming into being. It's more in that type of a framework. And if it should come up, so then it will, you know, the Kohen, when he wears that beggar, will be reminded of this idea, and he'll work on it, and he'll uproot it. It's more of a, you see, it's been incorporated in a permanent type of a way. It'll always serve that purpose. But apparently it must deal with emotions. These must be very, you know, strong emotions. They're not insignificant. They must be significant. And they will be necessary to be incorporated into the system. Okay?
Real quick question. I started in the middle.
The question that we asked, Moshe Schutt was asking about the idea about the Big Day Kahuna, that Rashi points out that the begotten were a machaper for certain averos, particularly he's mentioning the fact that they brought the chalavim or dam in a state of tumah. And the Big Day Kahuna were a machaper. So how could that be? Now the way we analyze the question from the primary from the angle is it seems to go against our entire understanding of kapara. That idea taken simplistically is dangerous, because the basic idea of kapara that we're operating with is that it comes about through tshuva. That's our notion, that if we learn from tshuva, the whole essence of tshuva is for the sinners to abandon his faith. And that to perfect himself, and that if he does so, I mean, the idea that he's dependent upon somebody else for kapara is a very, very difficult idea. So that was the problem. And then Ben mentioned the importance of begotten. So if you see, he mentioned the case of Nega, that in the case of Saras, you see that first it affects, it's really, well, that's, we don't have that phenomenon anymore, but that's a miraculous phenomenon, that's not part of nature. And the Jews were on a very high level, so the Hashkacha related to them in a way that would cause them to look into themselves. Yeah, that's a crucial idea over here, that when a Nega would strike the bias, because the person's house is an environment that has a certain effect upon his personality. And the begotten is said even more. He said when a person dresses a certain way, it affects his personality. He's different. He acts differently. When a person wants to go out on the town to engage in his fantasies and his instincts and so forth, when he wants to be with a certain group, a certain culture, a certain way of dressing. And when he dresses that way, he starts to act differently. So a certain look. He wants to have a certain look. Why? Because that's his self-image. So when the begotten when the nega affects the begotten, it hits home to the person. If there's a defect, he's operating with a dangerous self-image, which is causing him to go astray. His self-image is not the true self-image of Torah. So, now then, the connection we wanted to make over here was that, based on the Rambam, the Rambam holds that the idea of kavod in the Torah was sort of a double-edged sword. that is to say that to a certain extent it's a concession to man's weakness in that he could not be weaned away. Serving God through the medium of carbon is dangerous, according to the Rama, because it can cater to certain primitive emotions. It can. And you see, in the Torah, Rashi always points out that Malame Chiloshino, that the Moshe and Aaron did everything in the Mishkan exactly as God commanded. The question is, what do you mean the foot they wouldn't change? It means that they didn't introduce anything, any type of an idea of their own. They simply were subservient to the will of God. It's in the area of Karban, any human emotion which is not commanded, which is not based on something which is directly commanded of God, you can't do the Zohar. You can't approach God through your own emotional desires. It's got to be purely subservient to the direction of God. So therefore, the Torah allowed us to have Karbanos, but it had to be extremely controlled. And one of the mechanisms of control was that it was limited to the Beis HaMikdash. When the Beis HaMikdash was built, you couldn't bring a carbon anywhere else. And secondly, to the class of Kohan. It was given over to the class of Kohan. So therefore, the perfection of the Kahuna, the perfection of the Kohan, is vital. There's a defect, since your whole system operates through them, they have to be perfected. And if they are not perfected, then it'll lead to a breakdown of the system. Now, that's where the area of the begotten comes in. That when they approach the avoda, they have to approach it in the most perfected way. And they have to remove themselves from any false self-image. And therefore, they couldn't wear their normal begotten. Because the normal begotten, even in the Talmud Chacham, to a certain extent, their normal begotten. They reflect the idea of style. And style already is something which caters to the human imagination, human personality. These were objective begotten. They were halachic begotten. And they were based purely upon ideas and concepts. So in that sense, I tried to answer this question. So that the begotten was a vehicle for the Kohen to be remind them of certain emotions, certain ideas that could creep into the service. And as a result of that, it's a machaper. It's sort of a preemptive kind of a machaper. The machaper is structured into the very nature of the system. It's designed to be, why? Because the Torah understands, God of course understands all the emotions of man that are going to come up. And there are certain emotional reasons why people would do this type of a thing. So therefore the system has to be structured in such a way that it won't come into the picture because the Kohanim, the existence of these elements in the begotten will make the Kohanim constantly aware and zealous about this type of thing. And in that sense, the machaper. It's a different kind of a machaper. You see? So you have a machaper when a person did a particular aveira and he needs a kapara. So then it has to relate back to him. He has to do tshuva. Or he has to bring a carbon, whatever. Even if he brings the carbon per se is not a machaper unless it's with tshuva. But then there's a different type of a concept. It's a machaper in the sense that it means that the system is being set up in the best possible way to avoid this thing coming into being. So it's sort of anticipatory. It anticipates this type of thing, and the system is being structured in that type of a way. That's how I'm learning. So if that's the case, it's not a problem. I'm not talking that they did a sin, and this is going to be, because then why would it have to be a permanent kind of thing? I was going to say that Rashi says that it's Avon HaKachem and not Makrivim, not the people who brought it. The Avon HaKachem means a defect in the Kachem. It would seem to be in line with what we're saying. Because if it's Avon HaMakrivim, that was your question, Mark. If you're talking about a specific error that somebody did, so then it's difficult to understand how it's going to help. He has to do tshuva.
Mm-hmm.
And not because he has to do tshuva. He has to do tshuva, right. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about Avon HaKachem, so it means it's an objective type of a thing. The system.
Right.
Avon HaKachem is because the system is not being set up in the most effective way.
The idea of the government mentioned, I mentioned before you had come, that we do see that the Torah is concerned about how a person dresses. And that's in the midst of tzitzis. So Chazal say, well maybe we can just see if we can understand that Chazal. Chazal say, because it relates three particular things, three mitzvot together. I don't know the exact order, I'm just quoting the memory
I think it's called Mishiyeshlo Motfilin, the Barosho of Israel. One of us tefillin on his head and tefillin on his hands. And mezuzah, he has a mezuzah on his passover on his doorway. And tzitzis bevigdo. Those three things. I may be wrong on the order, but it's those three things are being linked together. So it says that he's protected. There's a number of different expressions. So basically, lo b'meir hu kotei, hu lo sinkur, too quickly, he has protection, whatever. What is the concept of the order? What do you see? There must be some common denominator between those permissions of tefillin, between tzitzis and bias. You see this connection, by the way, by Taras. You do see the connection by Taras, because Taras will affect three different objects. It affects the bias, it affects the begotten, then it affects the body, and that's the parallel. The mezuzah is bias. This is big go, and filling is the very body, the book itself. So all right. In other words, at a certain point in time, a person has to have a self-image. He has to define himself. What is essence? What is the essence of a person? Now, most people do so in terms of their psychological ego. They're looking for a certain magnification of the ego in the framework of this world. They look at themselves as being creatures of this world. That's their essence. Now, therefore, they seek to perfect all of those things that enhance that type of an ego. Now, what are the things? Well, first of all, the body, the beautification of the body. Right, that's the physical, in other words, like this, it's the idealized physical ego, self-image. That's a certain type of a self-image. And that's the essence of it has to do with the fact that man is a physical being. A nefesh chaya. You see, of course, that the Adam is a unique being, it's a hybrid. Now there's the instinctual part of man. But the instinctual part of man is different than an animal's, because it has a certain element of sophistication, you know, style, sophistication, that becomes the essence. But you see, it's a very powerful force. In our society, you saw that last year when Jacqueline Onassis, when she died, and she, and I'm not saying this, I spoke about it at the time a little bit. I had to give a speech just at that weekend somewhere, and I brought it in because I wanted to show that that people are influenced by externalism, by image. It's the concentration on an external type of an image. Now you see that the attention that she really drew, the gaze, I mean, all newspapers, fillers, you really, in terms of reality, she didn't hold any position. She isn't running for president. All right, it's a certain, they don't like the newspapers, but that's it. Any other first lady, you know, you read about the fact she died, and the next day you don't read about it anymore. It's no big deal. But she captured everybody's imagination, and when they interviewed people, what was so great about her? The grace, the style, it's all external. It was a proof. It had an impact upon you. There's some people like the idea. But those people, of course, that were sympathetic to that, they accused me of Jackie bashing, which just shows how people react. You could disagree with me. I have no problem with that. But I wasn't the game of that. I was making a point. So anyways, if that is the case, though, you see clearly that it's going to effectuate itself with regard to plastic surgery in the best way you can possibly, because that's closest to the... That self-image, person has to have a certain look. He's very concerned about his body. And of course, the garments are a natural outgrowth of that. You know, the two go together. Style. He wants to be stylish. He wants to create a certain. He's not dressing. The dressing is not because of functional necessity, but it's rather. I mean, dressing for functional necessity. I think there's a very good analogy, by the way. I just thought of it. It's a big day kahuna. Where do you see that? It's just, it's a crazy thought that came to my mind. But I think it makes some sense at a certain level. You see, there is, even our society recognizes that there is an importance in dressing, in gearing yourself to a certain task. Where do you see that? Just go to a hospital, go to a doctor. I mean, there's no reason why a doctor can treat you. I mean, you can go to a doctor, you can be wearing a shirt like I'm wearing a shirt. It's not, you can't tell me that the white, you know, whatever it is, that tunic or whatever is essential because of medical reasons, but it is important because he's not a doctor when he's dressed normally. He changes. In other words, he's going out of one personality, and it's a good thing. I believe it is a good thing because it focuses him. It causes him to be, right now, he is completely focused on his role as a healer. It's a different type of an attitude. It does have an effect upon him. Yes, soldier also. Okay, good point. Soldier also. The activities, the uniform has nothing to do with the, you can do the same activities in this outfit. So, but they don't want, you see, that the generals, intuitively, whatever, they intuitively understand that. They don't want a person with his normal attitude operating with his normal self-image, because you can have an army that way. Yeah, of course. They want to break, their objective in that point is to break that individuality. Okay, now I'm not going into the, you know, it is obviously that's a matter of a necessity. It's not necessarily the same objective, but you do see from that it has an impact upon the psyche. And of course, they have the bias. Those three things. So, those three, the bias, you see again, for a person, that's also a part of his personality. When people can afford it. So they try and set up a house and furnish the house and with all types of things which aren't really necessary in terms of basic existence. But are there because it expresses. The person wants to express himself. What does it mean? He wants to express that type of personality, that which is really rooted in, not in his true essence of being a Tzelem Elohim. So that's the basic idea, that the tefillin is begufo, which means to say that bezroo and berosho, it's the lay. The tefillin shall yad is opposite the lay, and the tefillin shall rosh is on the, it's on his head. It indicates it should focus, that the body is basically just a means. Essentially, it's only a means to house the neshama, the Tzelem Elohim. And his real nature, his real essence, is resides in the Tzelem Elohim. Insofar as he's involved in the world of Chachmah, and he can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that's what he should focus on. And this world is just, everything here is just temporal, and that's the idea of the begadim. The begadim. The tzitzis. The tzitzis reminds him of mitzvahs. That's his real purpose. His real, that's his function, that's his uniform. You see? So, and of course the same is true with regard to the bias. Every time he enters the bias, he sees the mezuzah. And the mezuzah is again the basic ideas of the existence of God, the unity of God, and our obligation to relate to God through Ahava. So therefore, every time a person is entering the arena, which would activate those emotions of that false self-image, based upon an instinctual being who is trying to magnify his ego in the framework of this world, so then no, he's reminded of the fact. He needs a concrete reminder that this is just temporal, that all of this is temporal, and the real person is that part of him which can relate to these eternal ideas. So that's an important thing. I must ask you. Of course, just to I'll get to you in a second, Moshe. To respond then completely to Mr. Fodum's question about the clothing, the Torah is concerned about clothing, but the Torah did not prescribe a uniform. You see, the Torah the Torah did it with the great, obviously with the greatest chachma, because that is not necessary. And also, the Torah wants the person needs a certain amount of room to develop. The person is not created in a state of perfection. See, and also there's other factors with regard to clothing. There's elements. There's evolution in terms of society, in terms of style, in terms of stuff. There's many factors. So first, of course, the Torah is not going to prescribe a certain uniform. That can be done in the framework of the Mikdash. So the Mikdash is a different situation. That's not daily life. When a person is going out there, that's, you know, overlap there is the thing of Volech Chavadarach, when you're out there in the world. When the Torah, you can't go out there in the world dressed in Big Day Kahuna. Now, you know, by the way, you see that Hasidic groups, like, I remember in recent years, when they had these different types of programs in the government, for groups that could claim, I'm against the whole concept, but I mean, you have certain groups that claim that they're handicapped, they get certain...
Disadvantage.
I remember, I think, there were certain types of Hasidic groups that were claiming that they also in business, they were disadvantaged, right, because of the way they dress. Because the way they dress, so then they're, you know, they don't have entree into a lot of different places. People want to business them and so on and so forth. The reason I'm against that is because I don't think that's the case. I mean, it's a free society. If you choose to dress that way, it's fine, but then don't go complain to the government that you're, you know, it's a self-made disadvantage. But the truth is that is not really essential. It's not essential to have a specific uniform. What the Torah did require, though, was tzitzis v'vigdal. And if a person is living with a correct philosophy, so then he can adapt the situation. If a person is doing business and he has to dress up, and because he has to, he will do so. But he won't, you see, he will not allow that to define his self-image because he has the tzitzis v'vigdal. Okay, but of course, when a person, in certain limited situations, like the kahuna, when they're involved in the avodah, so then they have to be in the highest level of concentration. You know, like a doctor. A doctor doesn't have to go around all day long dressed as a doctor. But when he's functioning as a doctor. Okay. That has to do with the fact that the Torah doesn't legislate all the particulars of perfection. It legislates with regard to a general idea of tzitzis. Then the person has to take that idea of perfection and utilize it himself. Now the Musar HaSkel is, when you in setting up your situation with regard to dress, if you say, well, I mean, to a certain extent, there's nothing wrong with wearing, you know, a garment that looks nice and it makes you feel good and so on and so forth, but, you know, the idea of moderation, the underlying philosophy, you shouldn't allow yourself to be in a situation where you're totally caught up in that type of self-image. That's your whole thing, you know, like it's become a major area of your life. The question that we're taking up is, as a result of the discussion, somebody raised the, because I gave the example of the military. I didn't mean, that just explains the fact that people, commanders are aware of the fact that the clothing will affect the person, and they don't want individuality. Too much, unless the guy does something, gives up his life to save the commander. you know. But by and large, they want conformity, which is a thing you have to understand. In an army, you're right. Any type of a team, an organization, to a certain extent, the person has to be giving up. He can't just do what he feels like doing. He's got to do what the system demands. So there is going to be a certain fashion. I didn't mean that is what the Torah is aiming for. The Torah is not aiming for that. And so then the question arises, what is the... And including clothing... And in furniture and so forth, wasn't my point to say that the Torah would be against any type of individual expression. You happen to like this style or the other style. I am not saying that. What exactly is the role? Where does it come in? At what point would it be appropriate and even beneficial? And at what point would it be not? That we have to define. That's for tomorrow. I just want to mention as you're talking. So I don't want to start getting involved in this particular group, I want to mention if I see them or not. In a sense, the concept, there is a truth in the concept that the clothing that a person wears can have a protective effect upon him, so to speak, right? Because he doesn't want to identify. Clothing is identification. you know, you dress a certain way, it means you identify. So they dress their way, which means that they don't want to identify. The other thing is that, again, like anything else, it can become a double-edged sword. That becomes an externalism of its own. Okay? That can become an external. When you adopt a certain look, it's very tempting. And that's why, I mean, I've heard some of my own rabbis, and Eastern European rabbis, you know, great for family at home, and I remember they rebuked one of the students for having a beard. And everybody thinks that having a beard is a very wonderful little thing. I agree with the point. Because nothing, a person on a certain level, perhaps, you know, he's a big Thomas Russell, so he has a beard. But every person automatically grows a beard, so that gives him a different false sense of security. He now feels he has the garb of a righteous person. And see, when the garb enables you to feel like a tzaddik, so that's not a good thing either. Then you don't work on the inner self. That is today, among the many Jews, the external is a different form of externalism, and they judge you purely by the external. And to them, the now the dress becomes part of the it becomes part of the essence. It becomes, and then if a person is not wearing the proper garments, so then he's a puzzle. That's a false type of a thing. It can become a double-edged sword. And when the garment becomes an end in itself, so even if it's a religious type of garment, and again, that is not mandated. You've got to be very careful. It's not mandated by halacha. When you're dealing with things that are not mandated by halacha, and it's mandated by certain people, by their imagination, their religious imagination, so that's also emotions. That's also part of their ego. That's why you have to be careful. You have to be on guard against the religious emotions, just like you have to be on guard against the instinctual emotions. It doesn't make any difference. An emotion is an emotion. And the proper path to Avodas Hashem is not through the emotions, it's the Torah. It's through the ideas of the Torah, true ideas of the Torah. It doesn't mean we don't believe in the idea that you just follow your conscience. That's absurd. So, that's an interesting idea. What the Hasidim are doing in this sense, by creating something which the Torah did not demand that you create. The Torah did not demand that you create a certain type of a religious garment, so to speak, other than physical. By doing that, you're really falling prey to the same type of thing. So you're really elevating clothing. And you're making an image out of clothing, except one is instinctual and the other one is a different, it's a religious image, but it's still an image. And insofar as it's an image which is based upon man's imagination, you see, of what he would like to be, but it's not based upon that which is our mandated, so then it's harmful. Dealing with the topic of continuing from yesterday, the question of the individuality. And we said that the begadim express a person's image, but it's an image which is based upon his view of himself as a, you know, instinctual type of a being. Maybe it's sublimated, but it's an emotional being. And the Kohanim came to do the Avodah in their natural clothing, because they have to remove themselves from that framework and view themselves in a totally different light. That their essence is really a being who has the capacity to express that Tzelem Elokim. And those begadim are totally different. Okay. Now the question is, in general, what is our attitude towards the idea of the individuality? Do we seek to avoid that in terms of dress and the house and so on and so forth? I think there's an interesting Rambam over here. Let's deal with this Rambam. The Rambam is in Hilchos Sanhedrin in Perek Yud-Bei. Halacha Gimel. It talks about the procedure by Dini Nefashot. And before you proceed, of course it all begins with the Edom, with the interrogation of the Edom. Before we proceed to interrogate the Edom, to initiate the case, there's a chi of Iyum. Iyum means to warn them, to try and intimidate them. Because, you know, we're concerned that there shouldn't be any conspiracy. And we want to Of course, we don't want to frighten them off. If they're really Eidos, then there's a chiyuv to testify, because we have to have mishpat. But at the same time, you have to make it clear to them how serious the situation is. So Bezin warns them. And the Rambam explains, Ketad Ma'ayman al Iskei Nefashos. How do we warn them with regard to matters of Nefashos? Alright? Omer Melahem, Shema Tamun Me'omed, Mishmua, Eidu Tiyed. First, we just inform them that, are you sure that you witnessed this? Maybe it's just circumstantial. Maybe it's a conclusion of yours that you didn't see it, or you heard about it. You heard about it from somebody else. O Shema Einatam Yodem Shesofenu Livdok Eskam, the breach of the Chazira. Or maybe you're not aware of the fact that we're going to interrogate you with the Drisha, the Chazira. Evu Yodim, be aware, Shalokh Dini Mamanus, Dini Nefashos. The Dini Nefashos are not like Dini Mamanos. Dini Mamanos, Adam Nosin Mamono, and was Kapelo. Dini Mamanos, a person pays the money, and he's forgiven. Dini Nefashos, in Dini Nefashos, Damo, his blood, the Dam Zaro, and the blood of his children, Fluyimbo, Atzof Kala Olam. You're responsible for it. We're trying to warn them about the enormity of what you're about to do. If you are lying, so then you're responsible for a terrible thing. You're killing the Damo, it's his Dam, but it's not just his Dam, because had he lived, he would have had children and children's children. So you're wiping out you're responsible for all that destruction. Sharei b'kayin emar, because it says by kayin, kol demei achicha to'achim. The Torah uses the plural, demei, the blood of your brother are crying out to me. Damo v'dam zaro, his blood and the blood of his brothers. Now he says, here's the part that is I'm sorry? His children. The blood of his children. Now here's the part that I think is relevant. Then we say to him like this, and this seems to be a little bit strange, it's like a strange turn. Because up to now it makes sense, you know, the severity of what you're doing. All this has to do with killing, usually the effects of killing. Now it says something different. L'fichach nivra adam yichidi ba'olam. That's why God chose a person singularly in the world. One person. When God created the world, he did not create many people, but he created one person. L'lanei to teach us shekala ma'aved nefesh achas min ha'olam, that whoever destroys one soul from the world, ma'an olam ilu ibeid malei olam, is we attribute it to him as though he's destroyed the entire world. Okay, v'chava mekayim nefesh achas ba'olam, and whoever saves one life, you've all heard this expression, of course, whoever saves one life in the world, ma'alan alav, we attribute it to him, ileo kiyem olam malek, it's as though he saved an entire world. Alright, that's one idea. Now it's just like this, harei kol boy olam. Thus, everyone who comes into existence, the Tsuras Adam Harishon, Haim Nivraim, they are all created in the Tsura of Adam Harishon. The Ein Pnei Kol Echad Mehen Domim B'Pnei Chaver, but the face of not a one of them is similar to the face. In other words, they're all the same, and yet they're all different. L'fichach Kol Echad V'Echad Yachol Omar, therefore each and every person can say, Bishvili Nivra Ha'olam, because of me the world was created. Okay, and I think there are some people that have such an attitude. But what's the meaning of this idea? I just want to quote the commentary here, brings down a quote from the Gemara. Lahagid on this idea of everybody was created in the Surah of Adam HaRishon, but Ein Pnei
So what's he telling us like this? Everybody's in the tzuv of the rishon, but each one has a different faith. Different, who cares? I mean, what's the point of that? And what does that have to do with the eum over here? It's a mishnah, which says, "Lahagid gedulasa shalakadosh baruch hu." This is the secret to greatness of God. She'adam tovea kama matbeos v'chosam echad. A person can strike. He strikes many coins, but they all have the same, the same mint. Mm-hmm. Remember, we have the capacity to make coins. If you make a coin, you make a certain seal or a certain mint, and then you can make many, but they're all identical to each other. Okay? That's the way we create. Kulam Dolman Zelazeth. They're all the same. Umelech Malchayam Lacham HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but the King of Kings, God, Tavah Kol Adam B'chosamo, he created each person with his chosay, with his seal. B'chosamo Kol Adam Rishon. He made the Matbeah. The Tzura of the Matbeah is the seal of Adam HaRishon. He ain't Echad Mehen Dom HaChavero. But each one is different. You understand? On a simple level, you understand the idea. When a person makes a product, right? Whatever it is, you make a piece of art, a piece of sculpture, whatever it is, a coin. You can make many, you produce many, but they all have the same imprint. Right? They're all identical. There's no difference. But God created everybody with the chosen, the seal of Adam HaRishon, and yet each and every person is different than his chalav. What's the point of it here? That's to tell you that the individual, l'fichach nivra Adam yechidi, that each person was, that God created man individually, to teach you the significance of the individual, and it's if you kill one person, so you kill the entire world, and all these ideas are interconnected. Now, what would you say that means? What's the idea behind it? So why did God create each person with a different look? What's the significance of that? Alright, so God can do it. Now you're telling us about the greatness of God, that God can do it. But then the question is, so why? If we're saying that there's basically, this is the way that the essence of man is the talent of him, and this is the expression of the talent of him, that's the purpose, and really we should not get involved in the emotional side of the personality, what we call individuality. So what's the point? What's such a great thing that each person was created with a different look? I'm translating. Maybe I'm wrong. So let's develop the idea. I'm just telling you the fact. The point that what makes people different, of course, resides with people all do live different lives. But that's because of the fact that they have free will. But that's not included in this idea. That's a different concept. That means that, but that would be true even if everybody was created with the same post. Everybody looked identical, right? We still have differences as a result of free will. Here we're talking about something else in terms of the creation of man. That's the problem. Then we're different because we have different personalities, different tastes, etc. But that stems from the accident. The accident, in other words. That stems from, not the telemorphism, from the fact that man is an instinctual being. Right? He's an instinctual being and he has emotions. And that's where you get into differences. Why aren't you getting into the realm of taste
decisions,
choice. Yeah, preferences, enjoyment, etc. There's where the elements of, the factors which don't seem to be part of the film come into the picture.
But that doesn't mean anything if
you're going to say that we should get away from that. Because those things are a distraction. And that's an expression of the instinctual part of man, which really takes him away from his true purpose. But insofar as we're involved, and you tell them to work in and fulfilling our objective, so then what's the point? Then we're not celebrating differences. We're really celebrating, we should really concentrate on the fact that they're all the same. Right? Well, what is, but, alright, so the only, so God, so for whatever reason, God created people differently and so on and so forth, right? Okay.
But my argument is that then, in my warning to you against killing, it's not the thing. The destructive element is not because of the. It's not because of the fact of these accidental things that's differentiated. It's because of the fact of the essential thing, the terminal kin, which unites us, right? So why bring in the factor of differences? To show you how terrible the killing is, we're going to mention the factor of differences. But what we're saying is the factor of differences that stems from the instinctual side of man, which really we should be trying to press. And say to detract us from fulfilling our true purpose. We get involved in this, our taste, our artistic interests, and so on and so forth. That's really hevel, imagination. That's basically the thrust of his question. So you have to incorporate this idea. This is a modification and elucidation of the concept of man as a selenol akim. In that framework of selenol akim, there's differentiation. So Rafael is saying that it's irreplaceable. Very good, very good. That's the connection as well. I mean, it's irreplaceable. But I'll ask you, why is he irreplaceable? Why is he irreplaceable? That you hit it right on the head. He's not irreplaceable. Another human being will come into the picture. I mean, if a car, if you destroy a car, it's not irreplaceable. You can replace it with another car. It's replaceable, but man is irreplaceable. I think that hits it right in the head. But please explain to me why he's irreplaceable. But again, I'll say, what is the essence? The selenol akim factor? Well, there'll be a new selenol akim coming into being, and insofar as it's selenol akim.
But don't we get the same selenol akim?
I wasn't the same type. What does that mean? What he's saying is like this. I believe what you're saying is like this, and I like the connection with Mamon. Because Mamon, he's saying, it's replaceable. Because it's an objective entity of Mamon. So if you lose, there's a loss, you can always replace it. But there's no way that you can replace what you're destroying because of the fact of individuality. And that is to say that there's two different types of individuality. There's individuality insofar as the person is manifesting as selenol akim. Therefore, the basic mitzvah, uvosid bakum, to cling to God, really means to cling to Talmidei Chacham, and to learn from their actions, because they represent the ways, insofar as they model their behavior and to express their selenol akim in the context of a human being, in the context of a human existence. And there's no question that there's different personalities, and each person has his own particular skills, certain different types of skills, in terms of the intellectual area, in terms of the emotional area, in terms of virtues, and so on and so forth. So I think that's the concept, that each person is different means that the manifestation, the way, what man is, in a sense, is it's a hybrid being, a connection between this element of the neshama and a physical constitution. This creates a human being, but of course you have the factor of bechira, there's no question about that, but this is a unique type of a phenomenon. It's not a predetermined. That's why in the animal world it's more or less predetermined. There's variation, but they're slight.
But that's why it's all dependent on free will.
Of course it depends on that.
It's otherwise,
I understand that, but if you...
But even so, if you're
utilizing your free will, there's a specific, there's an individuality. There's no, like, a one objective standard that we're all seeking to achieve. And each person will be different. The perfection of each person will be a different manifestation. So the concept will be the same. That is to say, that this is an individual who, if he's living correctly, he's made the choice, he defines himself, but his essence is basically to manifest itself in all of him, and to live a life which is patterned upon walking in the ways of God, so to speak. But how that will manifest itself in terms of him, that has a lot to do with his own particular kochos, his strengths, his weaknesses, his capacities, his propensities, and his challenges in life, and there will be an individual, and each one is a manifestation of the greatness of God. That's why we're telling him, if you kill him, you're killing something which is unique. You're destroying the Tzelem Elokim, but the Tzelem Elokim is a reflection of the Creator, and there is
No, there is no one person that in and of himself, right, can express all the various manifestations. That's why there are many. That's why the Yechidi, the individual, is extremely important, and that's why there are many. Because each one is different. Each one is different than the other one. So if each one is different than the other one, don't just so you'll say to yourself, Rafael had a very good explanation, but it ties in with money. If each one is the same, so you'll say, all right, so there's one less train, and I destroyed a train. I destroyed an airplane. So now there's one less airplane. So what? There's plenty of other airplanes. So you'll bring in, it's replaceable. It's the same thing. There's nothing unique that's irreplaceable. But when you're talking about Adam, you're talking, and the same thing would be with an animal. You can't say that each year you killed a lion, that's irreplaceable. But this lion, what's unique about this lion? It's all basically the same. All right, so one is quantitative differences. You see, you can talk about quantitative differences. But in terms of the essence, the only situation in which you can say that it's irreplaceable would be in the realm of Adam. Because in terms of his very definition, as a hybrid being, a tzelem Elokim who manifests himself in the framework of a instinctual and physical being, and has to subordinate his instinctual drive into the framework of the service of God, each person has individuality. And yet, at the same time, he's an expression of the same concept of tzelem Elokim. That is a unique and a new phenomenon which exists only by Adam. And that's why if you killed one person, it's Olam Malach. Because God created the world for the sake of man. It was all Lichvodi Barasi. So Shakal Bar Lichvodo, for the sake of the glorification of his name. And the glorification of his name is through this being who is itself Malachem. So that's it. For one, and then it would have been worthwhile for that one person. So I think that there is room, but it's not just room, but it has to be that way, that there is individuality. But there's two kinds of individuality. I'll speak about the other kind tomorrow. I'm not taking it yet to the specific of how it should affect you in terms of dressing and so on and so forth. That's the next issue. The essential idea of individuality, there's two concepts of individuality. There is one, I think, which is a false one, in which a person is based upon his own ego. Each person has a certain ego, a feeling being, from childhood. That's a psychological individuality. He feels that he's special, he feels that he's unique. And it's not based on anything in reality. That's simply based upon his own narcissism, self-love. And he's just looking for things to attach it to. If he has a skill, if he has a talent, he's just trying to promote his own greatness. So insofar as that is concerned, he realizes that he has to base it on something, so that he creates this concept of being unique, of being individualistic. That is not, since that's the objective of it, to promote his ego, that's not really the proper individuality. But the individuality, which is appropriate, is to discover his true individual makeup. That's because there is an individuality in reality. In reality, you are an individual, you are unique, you are different, you're not the next guy. And by the way, that ties in with the whole mitzvah of Lo Tachmah. I want to explain, and I can't do it today, but I want to explain to you how that's very significant in the framework of Lo Tachmah. I think that goes hand in hand with the idea that by definition and by nature, man is individualistic. And there to discover, but there is something that you have to discover. You have to discover your own individualistic nature and how you could use that in the service of God. Because your whole basic mission in life is the service of God. But the way in which you will serve God, the way in which you will manifest yourself as a Tzelem Elokim is unique and is different and is special. But that's the true individualism that a person should strive for. That's individualism, and that's a good individualism, because that's manifesting the greatness of God as a creator. You see, that's what we tell the person when before he's about to testify. Okay? Alright, to be continued. Paul?
We
were discussing the concept of individuality, and we went to the Rambam, which goes to Gemara, which says that there is there is a important idea of individuality in terms of the way God created man, and that is in the case where it comes up is in it's called Iyum, the intimidate, the warning to witnesses in a murder who are about to testify that someone else killed and will be subject to the death penalty. So we have to warn them of the seriousness. Part of it is an explanation that this is not like a monetary case, in which if you make them, if you're lying or whatever, it's replaceable. But each individual life, each individual, God created each individual in the surah, in the image of Adam HaRishon, and yet each one's face is different than the other one's face. That's how it's expressed. And as opposed to a human creation, because man creates many objects with one mint. He mints the coin, and then creates, all the coins are identical, there's no individuality. So you see that there is a concept of individuality, but we say that that individuality is inherent in the creation, in the Bria. That is to say, that we all partake of the same essence, which is the divine soul, the Tzelem Elokim. However, that is not the totality of man. The totality of man is the marriage, so to speak, of the divine elements into a instinctual being. Into an instinctual being. And therefore we said that each individual, that's why we're telling them, that don't think, because you would think, see, what's the idea behind it? It's a very important idea. In a sense, we're telling them that don't think that it's not so terrible. It's like, all right, so let's say one individual more, one individual less. So there's plenty of people out there on the planet, right? What we're saying is that each individual has a special type of a work, because he is distinct in terms of what he's supposed to be, a representation of the Tzelem Elokim. Now the various manifestations of that Tzelem Elokim are unique. So there is such a thing as uniqueness, a unique personality. That is to say, one who has lived his life properly, who has faced the essential challenges of life, each person has his own particular challenges, his own particular talents, his own particular abilities, and in the general context of living a life in which you are walking in the ways of God, there's specific manifestations. That's why we can learn from so many different people. That's part of our process of learning, is to attach ourselves to the Talmid Chacham, to perfect the individuals, because they are a reflection of this perfection, because they have molded their personalities in line with the ways of God, insofar as God has manifested those ways to us. As a matter of fact, one of the explanations that Reichade offered for the concept of Chiasamesim, resurrection of the dead, which we do believe, is a principle, it is a principle of our faith. Which means to say, we are obliged, as one of the 13 principles of Amunah, to believe that the phenomenon will occur. That is to say, that there will be, that is not, according to the Rambam, the ultimate reward. The ultimate reward is the immortality of the soul. But the phenomenon of resurrection, that is to say, the return, is this it when a person dies? Is it, he's finished with this world forever? Which is not a bad thing, kind of, and the next stage, if he's a tzaddik, if he's perfected, will be Olam Haba. Or is there the concept of returning to physical existence again? So the answer is yes. The idea that man will return to his physical existence is a principle of our emunah. Whoever denies the phenomenon is a kofir. The Rambam makes that very, very clear. The only thing is, as in many other cases, for example, the belief in the idea of the Mashiach, our obligation is to believe in the phenomenon itself, but the particulars that surround it, and that's what the Rambam was concerned about, the particulars. And he says that's why he focused his writing more on Olam Haba than on this, because people are not interested in Olam Haba, the ultimate reward, for obvious reasons. They're interested in the resurrection.
because and they all have the same question. You know, when you come back, what age? What will you look like? What clothing will you be wearing? You know, in the stuff you were buried in? You know, would you? You know, if you would you come back in your pristine state when you were good looking? You know, with glasses or with contact lenses or without? You know, that type of thing. And he says the reason for this is. And so, you know, you have to be a brilliant psychologist to figure it out. That is because people can only relate to physical existence. And the bottom line is that that's one of the challenges for Adam, for man, in terms of his perfection, is to really be capable of relating to and accepting the notion, the conviction that physical existence is not the only form of existence. As a matter of fact, it's a lower form of existence. And non-physical existence is the true existence. That's what prevents people ultimately from believing in God. And to the extent that we, even those of us who do believe, our belief is incomplete, it's not a perfect belief, it's based upon that thing. It's an ingrained a feature of the human psyche that he's very much tied to his senses. And a certain part of him always believes that only that which his senses perceive is true. And since something which is not physical can't be perceived by the senses, so then he relegates to a lower level. Of course, from a conceptual standpoint, it's totally different. And that's a big source of all the problems that people have with believing in God, with believing in the soul, with believing in the afterlife. You don't see it. You ever see it like that? And that means to say that seeing is believing. That's what people say. That's not the view of Yahadut. Perfection demands that a person really has to work himself clear out of that, and believing has to be based upon what the mind tells him to be true. Now,
does that have to be based on logic?
No. Chias and that, no. That's not. Chias and Mason is not something which a person can arrive at through logic. Yet I say it's logical to believe in it. Whereas the phenomenon of Tchias HaMeisim is something which goes contrary to the law of the nation. No scientist could ever discover it. Okay? So in that sense, it is not logical. It's not something which has, you know, it could happen due to the ordinary course of nature. But when I say it's logical to believe in it, it's because we know. How do we know that of the phenomenon? Since we have a system, of revelation which comes from the source of reality, from the being who is capable of, just like he was able to create the physical universe out of nothing, so too he can reconstitute all the elements. That is the source. Well, of course, any fundamental of our belief is based upon the total. It's not based upon anything else. You're not obligated. If I can demonstrate to you a principle, a scientific principle, which makes sense and is logical, you should accept it. But if you don't accept it, you're not in violation of any law. And it's the midst of the Torah.
But why is there something?
Right? I mean, other than the general idea that a person should accept it. Exactly, truth. In terms of truth, a person should accept the truth and he should be in line with reality, and therefore there will be a defect in an individual that he can't accept ideas if they don't appeal to his emotions, because then that's an imperfection. But I mean, you wouldn't call him a kofar. He's not a heretic. Large. The philosophy of the Torah, the ideas of the Torah, are true ideas which people who are thinking correctly and logically will perhaps would come to on their own and would recognize. That's a fundamental pasuk of the Torah, that the Torah is a system of logical ideas. Because it says, when the nations, right, the shmartem vasisem, and you shall guard them and perform them, the mitzvot. Now listen carefully. Kihi chachmaschem uvinaschem. So this is your wisdom and discernment, the eini ha'amim, in the eyes of the nation. If you can maintain, as most people maintain, erroneously today, I think just about all of those people, the so-called spokesmen for religious Judaism, are not in line with the book. Because in defending, when you ask them, when you interview them, from one group to the other group, the reasons for their practices, the kind of reasons they give, do not appeal to the logical mind. People accept it respectfully. Oh, this is a, like, say, the wall. Take a look at how they use, you know, most religious groups, they go to a wall and they write notes and put it in the thing. And people have respect for it because, you know, it's not, it's politically incorrect to be disrespectful to somebody else's religion, right? But no one is impressed by, wow, what a brilliant people this is. They've worked out a system of going to walls and they write these little notes. And today they even fax them over there, you know. This is unbelievable. Yeah, this is something. I got to really, I got to connect myself. This is a system that can really make a difference in my life, you know. And the truth of the matter is, if you make this claim, or we, you know, we in the yeshiva have gotten a lot of flack over the years, obviously, because when we make the claim that the Torah is rational and that one should study it to discover the true idea of the rationality, I mean, people, religious people, oppose it. They say, it's all faith, it's emunah, and we just have to believe, and we can't even know what the things are, what the reason. It's absurd. That whole idea, that notion is absurd. What do you mean we can't know? If we're given this Torah, I mean, aside from all the problems that that position maintains, obviously, if the Torah, if it's as they understand it, it's just blind faith, and you just do the deeds, and you have no understanding of why you're doing it, what it's all about, and the philosophy behind it, so I don't see how you can achieve any perfection as a result of it. No system is perfected. You could be just blindly obedient, but you can't achieve any human perfection. In other words, it's not designed for human life. Now, but this pasuk is Yihi Chachmasem. This is your pasuk. This is Chachma. Torah is Chachma, means it's wisdom, knowledge. It's true. It's true ideas to the extent of La'ene Ha'anim. In the eyes of the nations, which means to say, it's not only, most of the various groups and sects, so they have a leader, and they have their own, they've worked out their own ideas, and among, you know, it makes sense, it's pleasing to those, to the adherents, to somebody outside, who's listening to judge, in other words, if you don't start off with their premises, then it doesn't make sense to you. Here, the test of the others is that the others has to be objectively true ideas, that even an outsider, the Rambam says in one of his essays, or one of his letters, I'm not sure, that the test of whether a idea that you have of Torah is true is what the reaction would be. I think to bring it in this one, I have it in the house. What a Gentile would think of the idea. And that may sound crazy. He says, this is the opinion of this he gets from this prophet. But the prophet is giving you some type of a litmus test as to whether the idea that you have is true. Would a Gentile listening to the idea have this reaction? Here's the reaction. Asha Yishman is called Afukam Eila. He'll hear all these statues, you know, an exposition of the Lord, the system of Judaism. The Amru, and they will say, Rak am chacham v'navon hagayag v'lozeh. But only a wise and discerning nation is this great hagayag of this great nation, this great people. Now, this does. You ever hear anybody? People respect. That's a different thing. There is a respect amongst non-prejudiced or even prejudiced Gentiles. There is always a respect. Now, when people respect the Jews, they realize the Jews are intelligent. No one. No matter what they say about the Jews, those anti-Semites, because they never call the Jews stupid. It's the opposite. They maintain that the Jews are sneaky and sly and evil, and the problem is because they're dangerous because they're so smart. But that, you know, they are dumb. They don't call them dumb Jews. No one, that term dumb is associated with other Jews. And I'm not saying it's correct because I don't believe in that type of thing. I think that we should, I don't think we should indulge that type of thing. But I'm just saying, but that doesn't mean when they will say the Jews are smart because they see that the Jews are ahead in every field, you know, and they make money and that sort of stuff. But not because of Torah. It doesn't come from the fact that they hear an exposition of the Lord. They're so impressed by Shabbos or Kashrut, Tefillin, and so on and so forth. That is not the case because whenever they do interview the leading scholars and they do explain the philosophy of Torah, it's very rare that somebody will come up with a rational explanation and show the rationality of it. Nobody even seeks to do that. That seems to be out of vogue to the extent that no one,
and not even think it's the right thing to do, they fall back.
And all kinds of emotional types of things, our parents, our traditions, you know, and
even when they give reasons, it's like childish kind of reasons. But, you know, when you were taken out of Egypt and the blood and the rust, you know, things which, you know, which it doesn't seem to be uniquely, it doesn't seem to be a system of ideas, it's just, at the same time, you speak to people in other religions, and it seems to be along the same types of things. They have, that's why people do come to the erroneous conclusion. They have this idea of a Judeo-Christian tradition. So they're basically pretty much the same, you know. They don't see the significance of the difference. You know, like, comes Hanukkah time, so we celebrate this with our Hanukkah lights, and they have their lights, and this is pretty, you know, love and brotherhood and all the good things, and that's basically all for them. Right? There's no uniqueness. But the Torah is a system of what the real way to approach Torah, the true way to approach Torah, is to seek out the wisdom of Torah. To seek out the wisdom and the chokhmah, to understand to the greatest extent possible the ideas of the Torah and the reason, to the extent that we can. This does not mean to say that we are capable of unearthing the reason of everything in the Torah. There's no contradiction from that. Because just as we would say to a scientist, the objective of a scientist is to discover the reasons, the principles, the laws, to study the world of reality. But there are things that are always being incomprehensible because it is a result of the infinite wisdom. He can't fathom all of the wisdom. Okay, the same is true of the Torah. The Torah is the product of a being whose wisdom is not finite, and we cannot in any way come. You know, we can't grasp a fraction, so to speak, of the ultimate wisdom. So therefore, we'll always be left with questions. But that's not a contradiction. Nevertheless, the system is a system of chokhmah, and our objective is to fulfill ourselves to the highest possible degree in understanding the chokhmah of Torah, and of course in living by it, in internalizing it. I mean, it's such an intellectual game, that would be absurd. Because this is truth, and our objective is to mold ourselves in line with the truth, as it has been revealed to us by the source of truth. That is the real objective of Talmud Torah. But Lodge thinks just the opposite, and that is not the objective. And the objective is to believe, and the truth of the matter is they respect the person that believes in spite of the fact that he doesn't understand, and an unenlightened belief in their mind is greater than an enlightened belief. That's the view of most people, and that's not a Jewish, my opinion, that is not a Jewish, that's a Christian idea. That's absurd. Yeah, not the Mishnah doesn't contradict this. They cite that. Ironically, they cite that. But the greatness of the Jews, they cite this. They say the greatness of the Jews resides in the fact that the Jews just accept it. They cite the Chazal. That God went to the various nations, we've all learned this. That God went to the nations and offered them the Torah. See? Equal opportunity. It was equal opportunity. What? We're an equal opportunity. Okay. So, but they all asked God about the commandments, and you know the story goes: God said, "Thou shalt not kill," and so they, you know, they rejected it. "Thou shalt not steal," they rejected it. You know, and telling them more. And then we came to the Jews, and they said, "Nasa v'nishma." Now, people misunderstand that to mean that the other nations would not accept it because it didn't make sense to them, so they didn't have that amunah, and the Jews simply had amunah. Now it is true, there is a concept of amunah, very important, but when the Jews said nasa v'nishma, and meaning, let's take it to mean that, but the Jews did not ask for any type of illustration, and what is, so to speak, blindly. That doesn't mean that it was blind faith. That is totally enlightened. That's intelligence. Because the reason why they accepted it not was why? Because I don't need to have specific examples, nor do I have to understand them to recognize that it's a rational system. Because I know, once I know that it comes from the
from the God, from the source of reality, who's the ultimate source of wisdom, then it has to be good, and I have to accept it, even though it doesn't make any sense to me. That's what Chazal say, that there were two acceptances of the Torah. And this, they say, was an acceptance out of fear. And they say, the Chazal that says that, it says they sat, the Sakhta Sahar, they stood, rather, I'm sorry, they Yashu, the Jews stood at the bottom of the mountain. And the rabbis say, they interpret to mean, it is that they've got, God converted the mountain into like some dome and said that if you accept the Torah, then it's good. But if not, then I'm going to turn this upon you like a dome and it's going to be your dove. Meaning to say that, which contradicts, which means to say that they accepted it out of coercion, which is contrary to the plain meaning of the truth. Nevertheless, it says that in the days of Purim, because of the love of the miracle, they accepted it out of love. And to make a long story short, it means to say that the first acceptance at Sinai was voluntary. But you read the plain truth, because there was negotiation. Moshe went up and back. And God sent a message to the people that if you accepted it. So the Jews, it would seem, had the option to reject the Torah. But the Jews accepted it. So how can you say that they were coerced and God threatened to kill them if they didn't? It means to say that the original acceptance was not with love. Why? Because it was Naaseh v'Nishma. It means to say you accepted it because you had no choice. They recognized that they had no choice. That's the idea of the dumb. A rational person would accept it. Because once he knows that it comes from the source of reality, therefore it must be in his own best interest, even though he can't see how it is, because in your own mind, the Torah goes contrary. The way the national mind functions, the Torah would seem to be contrary. That's all the other nations represent. Because the person believes that his happiness lies in the uninhibited fulfillment of his instinct. So therefore you have a system of don'ts. That's why most people, even people that want to identify with Judaism, they can't accept it. The mitzvot is the biggest challenge. That's why all the other systems that challenge the Torah within our own, conservatives, reform, we've always had these movements that want to keep the Torah but they get free themselves from the mitzvot. Because the mitzvot appear to a person like a burden. They appear to him like a burden because a person is fixated on the notion that instinctual freedom is the path to happiness. That's all for you. But that's his common sense notion. Now, the Jews were no different at the time of Sinai in that sense. So there was a resistance. There's a resistance. However, they were intelligent enough to recognize that if God tells me that this is the path, then that's the answer. I'm willing to have to do it. I have no choice. In the same way, if you went to a doctor and you knew that he was the greatest doctor, and he prescribed a regimen which makes absolutely no sense to you, goes completely against your own sense of self. If you imagine that you should be doing these things and doing those things and this thing, and then he gives you a whole prescription which goes totally counter to that, it doesn't make any sense to you, but you have no choice. But the man has studied the field, he has much greater knowledge than you have, and it will be absurd. So you'll accept it, but it's not love. Yourself. But once you begin to follow through the system and you begin to see how it works and how it helps you, you go through the changes, so then it becomes conversion to love. That takes place at the time of Purim. I'll explain it later when we get to Purim. You see? But that it resolved the contradiction. So if you ask, was it an act of blind faith, not the mission for the Jews to accept the Torah? Absolutely not. It was rationality, because of everything they had seen led them to the conclusion that it would be absurd. They had an opportunity to receive a direction, the Torah, a guide to life from the source of reality, which on the surface of things, did not appeal to their emotions. It didn't appeal to their emotions. You see, right away they started their rebellion to me right away. Rebellion to count immediately. Now you can understand why. It takes a long time to make that transformation to the extent where it's in line with your own nature. They accepted the Torah, but it was not in line with their nature at that point in time. But that was it was rational of them to accept it, and for their credit that they accepted it. But to reach the level where you relate to the Torah out of love, that cannot come at the very beginning. It's an impossibility.
It's an impossibility. But that can only come through familiarity with the Torah, through study of the Torah, primarily through study of the Torah and implementation, and then you appreciate the ways of Torah, but then you're going to be drawn, that's the ultimate goal, a service of love. That'll be a service of love. But at first it's a service of fear, out of fear. That's what we call fear. Fear doesn't mean that literally God's going to destroy me. That's a low-level type of thing. This is a different type of fear. It means you've got no choice. I'm smart enough to know, no matter how bitter and painful it is, I'm smart enough to know that this is the direction I have to go. That's the only superiority that the Jews had over the other nations. The question that we had been dealing with regard to individuality, and we said that there's two kinds of individuality. There's a false individuality, which is not based upon the true nature of a person, which is based upon his accident. Each person is claiming a certain emotional an image. Each person is seeking, because he views himself as being essentially a creature of this world, and he wants to create an image which will gain him attention and admiration in this world. See? So that's based upon his self-love and his concept of himself as being a great individual. That leads, that's why he dresses in a certain way, because the dress is a certain image, a certain identification. Okay, and we said that's why the big day kahuna, the gadim, are extremely important, because the way a person dresses does have an effect upon his image. People will act differently. People will act differently when they're dressed in a certain way. It brings out certain elements. It can inhibit or it can bring out certain elements in the personality. Now, getting it down to a very practical level, does that mean to say that, so Moshe asked, there's no legislation on how we should dress, other than the fact that there is a rule with regard to tzitzis, reminding us of the mitzvah, but should we therefore seek to dress in a very grand kind of way, and not to seek any type of, not to relate to clothing in any fashion other than simply functionality. I mean, everything, people like a nice tie and a nice shirt and a nice combination, all these different things. Is there something wrong about that? That's the question that's been raised. And it's not a violation of the Torah, no one's saying that, but those who are seeking perfection, should we operate in that arena as well? And in other words, is there anything wrong about this type of furnishing your house, the particular things that you happen to like, and wearing the clothing that you happen to like? The personal element. The element of some self-expression in these areas, is there anything wrong with that? That's the question. That's right. In other words, would such a thing be harmful in the sense that it is perpetuating this false self-image that a person's walking around with? So that's a good question. Like style, I guess, is the word we use for it. Is there anything, fashion, style, and so forth, anything wrong with that? What else, say, Ben? He says, Dira Nora, a nice, Nora means pleasant. Pleasant for dwelling, pleasant habitation. Isha Nora, a pleasant wife. The Caleb Nora, and vessels, but I think Caleb also is the term which refers to clothing. Clothing. The term Caleb refers to clothing. Machiva is daito shalom. What does that mean, Mach? How do you translate it? It expands a person's maya. In other words, it's a good thing. It expands a person's mind. It makes life pleasant. And that's good. So that would seem to go a little bit, in other words, in the other direction. Now that, I would say, does leave room for individual choice. Because what's Isha no, it counts as Isha no to you, may not to me, but we're all individual, and dwelling, and so on and so forth. So I would say along these lines, yes. In other words, if the primary drive is because a person feels that he has to be in line with a certain style, the question is, that's his identification, then it's a negative thing. Because that already will affect his also with lots of lives. That means that he's tied in with he has to be in line with the views of society. So if that's the primary thing, that it's he doesn't really enjoy the thing itself for its own sake. But the reason why he likes it is because he can now feel, he feels depleted. His ego will feel depleted when he's out of style. Now, out of style means to say that he can't get the approval of this society, this image in his mind, of a certain society, a certain circle. And that's what you see, that's by the way what most people, what motivates most people throughout their entire life. That's what they're searching for. So then I think it's wrong. But since we're human beings and we do have emotions, so then a pleasant environment is something which gives a person enjoyment, a certain relaxation, and it's good for the mind. Because that's the way a person felt. When a person is in a good state, when he's relaxed and in good spirits, so then he can apply his energy to learning, to thinking. It's marhiman is that way. And when he's not, when he's uncomfortable, we're human. And even the clothing that you wear, if it's comfortable, and even as far as colors and tastes and so forth, there's nothing, again, all this is extremely important. With limits. Limits is the key thing over here. If you find yourself becoming a clothes off, that you can't leave your room, you can't leave the house in the morning unless you have the exact, you know, and the shoes, this stuff, then you see it's an obsession with it. When it reaches the point where it's an obsession and it's becoming an end and a value in its own right, then I think you got a problem. But where is your primary focus is upon your major purpose in life, And you should dress properly. A person should dress properly, given, you know, in the society that he's in, especially at Talmud Chacham. Should always appear in a, depending, you know, amongst the people. When he's amongst the ordinary people, he should always be neat. And that's what Chazal says. If he has kesem bevigdo, if he has a stain on his garment, he's chayav nisa. He's liable to the death penalty. Which doesn't mean literally. It means to say that it's a very severe thing because he's causing a chol Hashem. People will, People will make fun out of him. They'll say that he's a sloth. That a person who studies Torah is a sloth. Now, within that framework, if a person has certain tastes and he enjoys a certain shirt because it looks good and all of that, it's machiv and it's daito, but it's not something that's a major thing of importance to him. You know, you can tell the difference between people like clothing is like their whole life. You know, like, or so simply you happen to enjoy it. Then that enjoyment is like any other enjoyment. But you feel like any other enjoyment. It's a pleasant, it makes you pleasant, makes you feel good, and you stop thinking about it. Then it's marchim and it's data. The same thing with a house. Again, it should be with moderation. A person should be with moderation, live with moderation. You shouldn't attempt to be ostentatious. If it becomes ostentatious and gaudy and to impress, then it's bad. But if it's something that he enjoys, he happens to enjoy a certain type of a furniture, a certain type of a couch, and even if it's a certain type of a painting, which relaxes and is pleasant, if he's doing it for the sake of the enjoyment itself, and that enjoyment is in the framework of a life which is really geared towards the true purpose, then I see nothing wrong with it. I see nothing wrong with it. And you know what I'm saying? There's no, we're not saying, of course, there's really darker shaltara. I mean, the Rambam says that a person that wants to be crowned with the Kesher Shel Torah has to be completely, all of his energy has to be directed purely towards Torah. And to the extent he says that that's the Tanai, that Pastor Melech Tochal, you know, and V'Ala Aras Kishan, you know. I'm not talking about that. That's true. That if it came to that, it means to say that you don't have your energy invested in those things. You don't have your energy in your, the draw in terms of your energy is towards the involvement in Torah. But insofar, I mean, each person has to know his own nature. You can't go against your own nature. You have to know what's extremely important. You can't try and act as though you're on a level which you're not. You destroy yourself. You can't do that. So there are certain legitimate physical and emotional satisfactions that a person needs. Now, as I say, in the area of clothing, in the area of furnishing, if you happen to have certain things that you enjoy, there's nothing wrong with that. So that's not, provided that it's in that framework that it gives you a certain relaxation, a certain peace of mind, makes you feel better, Of course you should pursue those things, because you need those things in order to function at your best. You should not. That's against, you see, this is a very important point, because a lot of people would say no. You should negate these pleasures, and there's a certain benefit in being in a state of pain, and in renunciation, and asceticism. They extol the person who's in a state. That's not the view of the other. That's a crazy kind of an idea. You should know your own nature. You should be the Rambam in Hilchos Deos. To live a life in accordance with moderation is the key. It's extremely important, because that is the most, that is the state in which a person will achieve that psychological equilibrium, which is essential for his functioning. So that, I would say, that's the idea of Bira Noet. A person should seek to establish a lifestyle in which he can have those things that he truly needs. But then, you see, you have to be very careful with drawing the line. You have to be very careful with drawing the line. It should not be the case where a person is so hung up on that, where if you can't get the right color, like you know people that are into that type. Women especially are into this type of thing, more so than men in general. You can tell where people are so hung up on the particularities of everything, and if it came in, but it wasn't just the color combination that they wanted, so they go crazy, then you see already a person, this is more than just a normal type of enjoyment, but it's become an obsession. And then men in their own areas can get hooked up on the same thing too. But that's how I would, at least for starters, that's my explanation. As far as dress is concerned, I would say there's two kinds. If the dress is comfortable and the person, we went on that discussion over here about, because there were, different periods of time in the yeshiva. One for one, guys were wearing certain kinds of shirts. The shirts with different groups, rap groups, whatever on there, and that type of thing. So I was opposed to it, to allowing. We had a big discussion about it. So, okay, whatever. I thought that we should not allow that type of thing. We do have a certain type of a minimal dress code. I mean, not that demanding. But I thought that particular thing I thought was not good philosophically, because if you choose a shirt because you happen to like the color, so that's okay, because that's a matter of taste, and what's wrong? Do you like this color, like that color? But that does not mean to say that you're identifying with a certain group. Where you have a shirt which is an emblem of a certain type of Iraq group, that means to say that you value that. I've put out big arguments with people, students over what they deny, but I maintain that the enjoyment of that, wearing a hat with a name, you see, when you're wearing a cap, whether it's a baseball cap or a team or whatever the case may be, so then it's not because you like that cap. It's because it gives you a feeling that you're part of that culture. You identify with that group. Then I say it's a bad thing. A person who's living his life of Torah should not need that type of identification to make him feel his image of himself should be as one who's involved in the study of Torah, and the people that are living a completely false existence, and he feels because that's what motivates them, that egotistical pride, and he partakes of that vicariously through identifying with them. So I think he should work on that emotion. See? So again, I'm saying if it's a matter that he likes the style because it's a certain identification. It enables him to feel that he's part of a certain group. He's going to get the approval of someone. So then it's something he should work on. If it's something because he just happens to enjoy it, so then I say it's okay. Provided, of course, it's in machshavah and style. Nothing wrong with it. The thing is like this. I don't think we should do more than what the Torah requires. We should try and perfect ourselves in line with the Torah. And basically, in terms of dress, like in anything else, insofar as the Torah is concerned, we have certain laws. Shachmas, of course, as you know, the negative. And we have the positive of scissors. Okay? Other than that, we have prohibitions. We can't dress. You see that concept is true with regard to docket. In other words, you can't copy the ways of the guy. In other words, idolaters, how idolaters dress. Because that's, so you see that that type of an identification with groups of people who have the false philosophy is, excuse me, is prohibited. You know, a certain set, a certain group of people dressed in a certain way, like Amish or something,